and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Kyena Panchoni. Panchoni is a conductor, award-winning composer, and a percussionist. She currently serves as the music director for the Binghamton and Ithaca Community Orchestras. Welcome to the show, Kyena.
Thank you so much, Tish.
Glad to have you with us. I want to begin with the fact that we do know that children are brought up taking piano lessons and playing in the school band, but I was wondering, what turned you toward percussion and conducting as a career move?
Oh, wow. I wish I had a real romantic story to tell, but it was kind of goofy. When I was very young, my mother gave me violin lessons. My brother was a violinist, and of course, anything my older brothers did, I wanted to do. So I took violin lessons, and I guess I wasn't that bad. I thought I was bad because I was surrounded by what turned out to be prodigy children. Uh-huh. Like all my friends ended up going to Juilliard and all these great schools, and I just thought I was really behind the ball, so I dropped out. I said, forget that, I don't want to do that. And I picked up a band instrument, and when they usher you into the band room to decide what instrument you play, I found the biggest one, the sousaphone, and I said, I want to play that. And so she put me on a baritone, which is like a euphonium, it's a small version of a tuba, working me up to the sousaphone, and I couldn't handle the blowing into it in the condensed air, they call it. So quickly I was moved from there and into the percussion section because it didn't require a mouthpiece.
So that's really why. So it was by happenstance
that happened. Completely by happenstance. And that subject actually fascinates me a lot because I've talked to many friends who are now either avid amateur or professional musicians, and the stories of how they chose their instruments are fairly random when you think that you're going to be in this for a lifetime. And of course, you don't know that when you're 7 or 8. Uh-huh. You just pick the one that seems fun. So, you know, I could add, subtract, multiply, and divide, and percussion was pretty easy, like 16.
Well, what about conducting, though? It's been a male bastion. And so did you have role models and encouragement as a young woman to go into this?
You know, I really did. I was very fortunate. Where I come from, there was a female conductor of the Youth Symphony and also of the Symphony Orchestra.
And you're from Alaska,
I'm
correct?
From Fairbanks, Alaska, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so Madeline Schatz conducted both the Youth Symphony and the Fairbanks Symphony Orchestra. And so I had seen a professional conductor work in that capacity. But also my band teacher was a female conductor. Mm. And I guess I grew up as a very liberated young lady. It never occurred to me that a lady shouldn't do certain things, ever, actually, until I was quite older and someone said, don't you think that people might think you shouldn't do this?
And
I was well, maybe.
I'm wondering why it still is a male bastion. I mean, obviously women have made strides in Sarah Caldwell, and there have been some famous conductors. And,
yes.
And now we have Marin Alsop, who's making great strides. Amid controversy still, you know.
Yes, at the same time, I think at this time and in kind of this political environment, in some ways being a female conductor can be an advantage. Boards are looking for diversity. They're looking to engage a younger audience. They're looking to engage an intellectual audience. And as many of us know, those boundaries of kind of these patriarchal systems and these matriarchal systems have really broken down, and I have rarely found anybody in opposition to my goals to be a conductor. If anything, it's been the opposite.
That's great to hear. That really is great to hear, because I was looking into history and there still haven't been many. So it's great. Maybe things have really turned around in regard to this.
I think it has. In terms of, and you're right, it's kind of the number of women in professional orchestras has really leveled out, although I think they've probably continued to grow in the community ensembles and choirs and in orchestras and in youth symphonies. I'm sure that has continued to grow as women have had the opportunity to have work outside of the home more and more, and had support in doing that. The path to being a professional conductor is incredibly rigorous and is almost exclusive. And I think many women have a lot of different aspects and elements to their life that are as important. Not to say that men don't, but historically speaking, they've been able to have those and have their exclusive careers as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think that part of it is still difficult. It is difficult to be a mother of two and be touring the world as a conductor, doing all of those things. And I would imagine that most professional musicians of that caliber have a similar experience if you're a female concert pianist or mm-hmm. what have you.
I want to ask you, too, when did you begin composing?
Oh, well, I don't know if that counts, but...
tell us.
In fifth grade, I tried a... They have these little arts competitions, and I had tried a little snare drum solo that I wrote and did some stuff in high school. But I tried pretty young, yeah.
Uh-huh. And then when did you actually compose something that turned into a real piece?
I think... Well, I did one composition in high school that was a concerto for trumpet and orchestra, and not that it was necessarily particularly good, but it was playable, and we did perform it at my high school, which was really a delight. And then when I got to college, I started working on my percussion composition.
Uh-huh. And that brings me to, I would like to listen to an excerpt from your composition called The Creation.
Oh, okay.
The piece is very otherworldly. Tell us about it. It's like being in space.
Oh, well, this is... thank you. this is a big piece for me. I worked on it for about a year and a half. Mm. And it depicts kind of my envisionment of the sonic creation. It has a very strict program, actually, and that adheres to a series of 12 notes called a 12-tone row, and probably many of our listeners have heard of that, but if you haven't, the chromatic scale contains 12 different pitches, and when at the, kind of the beginning of the 20th century, when people were moving away from tonal music and moving into atonal music, they developed this system where one note didn't have precedence over others, and so a 12-tone row embodies all of those pitches. And so I created a 12-tone row embodying kind of the summation of the universe, and I used that to depict the world as a manifestation of sound, and the creation of the world and the universe as a manifestation of sound. So it begins with this, it's a hum. It's as if there's this non-formed sonic texture that just kind of
sets up. It's like a vibration.
Yes, it's very much like a vibration, a non-pitched vibration, although if you're going to put it in music, it has to have a pitch. Anyway, so it ends up having a pitch. But
Technical.
I get details. although with some of the percussion stuff, it's kind of, I sound non-pitched. But that, but in short, that ends up gaining centrifugal motion, imploding, exploding, and each one of those fragments end up becoming our sun and our earth and water and all the different elements.
Wow, it's fascinating. And you did win an award for this. Tell us about that. And it sort of got you some national attention, correct?
Yeah, I was very fortunate. There is an annual competition that the Percussive Arts Society hosts, and it's an international competition, although I would imagine the bulk of the applicants are from the U.S. And they had each year the category is different, and this year it happened to be, I didn't write the piece for the competition, but it happened that the instrumentation, the duration of the piece, all fell within the bounds of the competition. So I submitted it. And I was fortunate that it had won the first prize. And when that happens, kind of the network of percussionists, people are aware of what goes on with the Percussive Arts Society. And so many college teachers became aware that this piece existed, knew that their colleagues valued it highly because it had won the award, and it became programmed across the U.S., which has been really a delight to hear. People will send me recordings of different colleges and universities that have performed it. So that has gained me some national recognition.
I wanted to ask you, too, when you're composing for an orchestra, is it always a work in progress since you need so many factors to come together? How do you pull a composition like this together when you do need so much instruments coming together, and so you work as a choreographer in some ways.
In some ways, and let me make it clear for our listeners. I have done some orchestral writing. The piece that we're talking about right now is for percussion ensemble alone, and so it's just percussion instruments, and there are no strings. And in that sense, the instrumentation is limitless, and it's a little intimidating because you have to decide what sound do I want. It could be anything. And then find the cans or the chains or whatever it is that you need.
So it is an experiment until it's finally in your head the way you, or comes out the way you have it in your head.
Yes.
Is that so?
When you say experiment, how do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's not in stone until you hear the sounds that you want to hear from the percussionists who are performing the piece that you've created.
When you say in stone, mean that that I don't know what it is until I've heard them do it?
Is it a written piece? Does it end up being a written piece that other people can perform exactly the way you have it in?
Yes. And for percussion ensemble, it is it's a challenge in and of itself to notate it. Because
that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so when you're dealing with non-traditional instruments, you have to give all of the information that you can for the performer to be able to recreate the sound that you heard just using these black dots and stems and ink and, you know, little pictures and diagrams saying use this part of the stick and hit that part of the cymbal and, you know. So it is a challenge, but given the recordings I've heard, by and large, I was able to get the effects that I was looking for.
Oh, that's amazing. That really is. Now, I know you were appointed as music director of the Binghamton Community Orchestra in the spring of 2004. Tell us about this experience. What's it been like?
Well, it's been wonderful. I have to admit that. And if there's any Binghamton Community Orchestra members, you guys should know I absolutely love working with the group. I was fortunate to have a conducting position that opened up right as I was getting out of graduate school, and I applied for it, and very fortunately for me, I was at the right place at the right time, and they were looking for someone of my personality. And working with community ensembles is rewarding because the individuals there really, they want to be there. They want to play. They do it out of passion. They give so much of their lives, particularly in an orchestra that rehearses every week. These are people that have full-time jobs, that have children, that give up one evening every week to come in and play. And frankly, we have a very fine orchestra. These are very fine amateur musicians that come together and work. And so when you're able to get through those rehearsals and at the concert, pull together this rich artistic event that isn't just even, hey, we got through it, we played it, but that was enjoyable and a community event not only for our rehearsal and doing it, but also for the people that were watching it. That sort of experience is invaluable, I think, for me and also for the other people involved.
Mm-hmm. You also serve as the music director for the Ithaca Community Orchestra and the Grassroots Festival Chamber Orchestra. Tell me exactly what a music director does. Are you in complete control of what the program will be and so on? Tell us.
Yes. So in the capacities that I am music director for the Binghamton Community Orchestra, Ithaca Community Orchestra, Grassroots, a lot of the work and management of the orchestra does kind of fall on my shoulders, and for each one in different capacities and different ways. But it means that I choose venues, find players, choose the music, study the music, teach the music, you know, organize the performances, make sure everybody gets in and out at the right time. Mm-hmm. And so that's not always the case with a music director. If you had a music director of a professional orchestra that had a personnel manager and had a librarian and had, you know, there's all sorts of ways that those tasks get broken down in a professional situation. But I think you would find with any amateur group or a youth symphony that music directors do a good bulk of what needs to get done.
Uh-huh. And do you actually teach while you're doing this? I mean, if you're working with amateurs, are there people that still need a lot of guidance in regard to
Absolutely.
How to play, and you're able to do that, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, they're in different ways. I really wish that I had more skills in that regard, and I'm working on developing them. You always find the place that you're weakest and work hard to become better at those things, to better serve your ensembles. There are instruments I know more about than others, so that helps me help those out. For example, our local community orchestra I've only had for about a year, and we're growing rapidly. It's just so delightful to see how many more people have joined the ensemble. And that ensemble, I'm able to do quite a bit more teaching than I am in the larger Binghamton Community Orchestra, where I have more advanced players, we're doing harder repertoire, we have shorter rehearsal stints, and we have more concerts per year, etc.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kayena Ponchoni. She's a conductor and a percussionist. I want to listen to another excerpt from one of your pieces. It's called Of Magic and Means. Title fascinates me. Tell me where that came from, because this is another one that brings up a strange landscape to me.
They all have their stories, I have to admit. I don't think I've ever written a piece without a story. This is actually a more personal work, where I met a person who has become a very dear person in my life, who comes from a popular music background, and I've come from my classical music background, and I had just finished this atonal piece, you know, with no pitch center and everything, and everything in his world is very kind of structured and organized by this tonality. And I shouldn't say everything, but many things. And so the tonal kind of structure of that piece for me is blending these two ideas. Some of it's very based in one key, and then some of it really branches out, and that was fun for me to play with. The title comes from actually that person's meaning to me, of bringing some magic back into my life that I had lost, and the means in terms of kind of the practical elements of life that this person was able to bring for me.
Uh-huh. I also wanted to ask you, because you are from Alaska, I know you're from a big city in Alaska, Fairbanks, right?
big city.
Well, sort of.
Yes,
I mean,
of course.
Because a lot of people's vision of Alaska is this incredible icy landscape. And does the Alaskan landscape come into some of your music? Or is it so pop, you know, I mean, is Alaska so populated and our imaginations are totally wrong about the landscape, you know?
I think it comes into the music indirectly. The Alaska landscape is deeply embedded in who I am.
Hmm.
And one of the great reasons why I have stayed here in Ithaca, not only because it's rich artistically, but because there are elements of the land, and particularly elements of the land where I've chosen to live, that remind me of home and remind me of Alaska, the types of forests that we have, even though they're not the same trees. And much of what I write stems from that emotional space, this connection to the earth, this connection to the life around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that most deeply when I'm in those surroundings. And so it's not, I haven't yet written a piece that specifically depicts that. But in order to dissuade any imaginings, no, Alaska is not an icy, frozen waste. And in fact, in the summer, it's incredible. It's nicer than it is here. No, I didn't say that. but it really can be. 24 hours of summer, every day, you know, you can just be outside at 2 a.m. You decide to go camping or fishing or, you know, whatever it is you want to do. And in the winter, it's gorgeous. The interior where I'm from is special because it doesn't have a lot of wind. And so in the winter, we get it here every once in a while, but the snow just keeps building on these branches and building and building. When it snows in September, that's the last snow to melt in May, you know. So, and if you don't get much wind all winter, then you've got these trees that are just billowing over with these gorgeous snow caps. And you don't get that so much here.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah,
and then some people would say, thank goodness.
Right. Well, that's very true.
Yeah, but I think the landscapes where we're brought up do stay in us, and whatever creative work or whatever work we do, we bring that with us. I really do. I really wanted to ask you about that for that reason, because I don't know anybody who was from Alaska, and I thought it would be fun to ask you about that. Now, I also know you're a big advocate for new music. So tell us about how that has manifested. You're part of the organization called Tabula Rasa?
Yeah, that is correct.
Mm-hmm.
For me, living composers, living music is some of the most important music. I absolutely love the great music, Beethoven, Mozart, of course, other perhaps lesser known older composers, but in that when you're on a podium in front of an orchestra, that music is incredibly infectious, and I can't imagine what we would do without it. Similarly, that music wasn't created in a vacuum, and its importance stems from when and where it happened, and the quality of the minds that created it. And that's happening all around us. And like visual arts and written arts, musical arts, well, and you know, physical performance art, musical arts are a collaboration both of the artists that creates them, the musicians that perform them, and the audience that receives them. And I think that it is so much more meaningful when that whole thing can happen within one unit of time, I suppose, when you have a composer who is present and working with musicians to present that to a community where their experience, you know, is in direct relationship to the people that will be witnessing it, is mm-hmm. what they have. And I think writers have that on kind of a more anonymous scale. But it is contemporary. We read books by contemporary writers mm-hmm. without batting an eye. We watch plays by contemporary writers without batting an eye. And I think many people are reluctant to listen to contemporary music.
I agree with you. And you do hear people say, what happened to the great composers? Who are they now?
Right. You know? Well, they're Christopher Rouse. They're Stephen Stuckey. They're Roberta Sierra. I mean, people that live right in town, which is really remarkable.
Yeah.
And I think that people would find, too, just even coming to that heard our grassroots performance, people like Mayor Buell and Hank Roberts that live right here in town are making music that people like.
Oh, yeah.
People love.
Oh, there's so much great stuff out there.
It is. And it doesn't have to do with instrumentation. And mm-hmm. there's plenty of pop music that people that are into pop music don't want to listen to either because it doesn't appeal to them in one way or another. Mm-hmm. There is, if you don't mind indulging me just quickly.
Oh, right ahead.
There is a theory that many people support that one of the reasons why the populace has moved away from listening to as much classical music, contemporary classical music, is in the 20s, 30s, 40s, maybe even the 50s, there were several decades where the kind of the core of classical music production was moving towards this atonal bass that wasn't necessarily intuitive to most people that didn't study music.
Mm-hmm.
When I was talking about my 12-tone piece, it actually comes from that tradition, I have to admit. I pulled from these sorts of harmonic and melodic structures that were built, and then I put it into a context to me that seemed accessible. But when music moved in that direction, people that weren't analysts and people that weren't music students didn't find that they were being communicated to. And so people turned away from listening to what was happening, you know, what was coming out. You know, at the turn of the century, Strauss and Debussy and Mahler. I mean, people went to those concerts. And we didn't, of course, have the same perpetuation of recorded media that we do now, which, of course, leads people to listen to whatever they choose to listen mm-hmm. to. They don't have mm-hmm. to go to a live concert. But I think that people are starting to come out of the woodwork and say, oh, well, listen to this. You know, Steve Reich, he's not so bad. I really like Steve Reich. People that haven't listened to other music really enjoy that, or even Philip Glass, some of the minimalist composers.
I like the Kronos Quartet.
Oh, they are. And they have.
They are fabulous.
They've made strides to bringing the kind of art music, as it were, to a public audience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now you have a commissioned piece that's going to be played in Brazil in the fall. Tell us about that.
Well, that was, it was really a delight to be
from at. Alaska to Brazil.
Yeah, that's true, from Alaska to Brazil. When I won the competition for my other piece, The Creation, and I got some exposure, a gentleman from Brazil, who is part of the Percussive Arts Society and teaches at Santa Maria in southern Brazil, approached me and asked me to write a solo marimba piece to be premiered at a percussion convention this fall in Brazil. And so I wrote a piece of music called Sacred Feast, based on the text by Khalil Gibran that many of you know. And so, yes, I get to fly down to Brazil in September. I'm so excited to hear it performed.
And do you get commissions a lot? I hear musicians saying they're being commissioned to do things. And how does that work? People contact you and say, I want a piece for a specific event?
I wish I could say I get commissions a lot. I'm hoping that, you know, more pieces will be generated through that process.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, that's exactly it. Someone will say, I'm interested in you having you write a work. This is how long and for this instrumentation, maybe about this topic or what have you, depending on what the parameters of the commission are. And then you set your price, or your agent. For professional composers that have been doing this a long time, we'll have an agent that negotiates that price with the client, whoever's looking for the composition.
We're almost out of time. I just want to ask you one more question about what kind of advice would you give a young woman who's wanting to get into music? What would you say to her? Just go for it?
Yes, just go for it. Follow your heart. Don't ever question that you shouldn't. Only question that you want to. If you don't really want to, don't do it. There are many other things to do. It's a hard life.
It has to be a real passion.
It really has to be a real passion. And if it is, and if you are fulfilled by the act itself, and that when you do it, that is enough, then do it. And there's nobody to say that you shouldn't.
Kayena Pacioni, thank you so much for being with us. We have run out of time.
Thank you very much, Tish.
Our audio producer is Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.